Daily written calendars, though, are a thing of the past. Does anyone at home still keep track of their calendar written? Anyone here in the congregation? I don't see any hands here. I have a question then for you. How is Google, Alexa, Siri, the legal and illegal internet advertising companies, various nayfaring internet trolls, how are they going to know what I am interested in and what I am doing at any time whenever I get online, and they will remind me? How are they going to remind me of that if I keep my calendar on a piece of paper instead of online? No one writes anything down anymore, except for the hands that went up in this room earlier. And some reaction online. Okay, people are putting down your comments. I know. I expected it. Okay, so 95% of our staff here at Good Shepherd write their calendars down on a physical paper calendar. And truth be told, it's really funny because there is a sense of giddiness and excitement every year during a staff meeting when Ellie announces or asks in her just amazing, calming voice, district, it's so funny to me, denominational district calendars are out. Would anyone like me to put it in order? And everyone goes like this, except for me, and everyone else, except for me. And they love the written denomination calendars, and actually they love being able to remember appointments and be on time for things. I think it's a bunch of hocus pocus magical hogwash, if you ask me. Actually, here is my secret confession to all of you who have graciously over the years offered this advice to me. Josh, will you please just write it down so you won't forget it? Here's my confession. I love that idea. I love the idea of having one central location where I record absolute every detail of my life. The idea of which I could be timely and prepared in a single bound. And with a strength of 10 accountants, I could complete all of my Excel financial documents early. But it's not for me. It's because I know if I had all of that information in one place at one time, I would be lost forever. And I will forever be on the tardy list at school. My confession is this. I love that idea. The only problem is that 100% of the time, eventually, I will misplace it, that I will lose that planner somewhere. I'm forever doomed again to be that one kid who's always, for some reason, sitting outside of the vice principal's office at school in the scene in every single movie. But I do have a soft spot for some written calendars. I like those the flip ones, right? The classics like The Far Side or Whiteout Comics. Anybody remember Whiteout Comics? Shout out. The kind you can only find at an actual bookstore or the Hallmark store. Remember the Hallmark stores? Do they still have Hallmark stores around? Are they still around? It's the one place that you are guaranteed to find a gift for your mother or grandmother that they will proudly display on their shelf for the rest of their life, the Hallmark store. You cannot go wrong. And anyway, I love the rip-off calendars because every time I look at it, I know that every time, without a shadow of a doubt, that the date that I'm currently looking at is most likely, about 98% of the time, probably not the correct date. So what I get to do is I get to pull that date off, crumple it up, and throw it away. I get to start a new day. Every day. And even though my days are filled like yours with successes and failures, with hope and despair, with elation and even contempt, with sin and with righteousness. Every single day starts new with a flip calendar, and it starts fresh. And with a new flip calendar, you're reminded of that every single day, every single day. And if you're lucky enough, if you're lucky enough to have memorized the Book of Lamentations, which I may or may not have done, you might be reminded when the prophet Jeremiah, this poet prophet, in the midst of his affliction, writes this in Lamentations 3, 22 through 23. He says, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never, ever come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." Wouldn't it be amazing to wake up every morning and that would be your first thought of the day? To think the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. And they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Instead, usually I ask this question every morning. Who am I? Where am I? You know, just trying to figure it out and get started. See, Lamentations was composed in the reality of daily pain, of daily failure, of daily despair for Jeremiah. It's Hebraic poetry by the prophet, and the mourning, the desertion of God's, of the city of God, that God's people had left, and then its destruction, and how everything, when everything seems to be lost, when he was finally at the bottom, when you feel like Jeremiah, when you can't take one more thing going wrong. It's a worship song composed 2,600 years ago. And it finds a way to remind you and to remind me that God's love never ceases and there is always hope. See, Jeremiah found a spark left in the ashes of destruction. And it reminds us that God's love cannot be stopped and won't be held back by anything. That God's love knows no border, no boundary. That God's love has no map. That there is no wall built that will keep away God's love. Not only that, but God's mercies never, ever, 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 ever come to an end. I can't say it enough. Though most days seem filled with more fear than joy, nowadays, more tears than laughter. This day, though, this day starts a new day. And nothing is stopping God's love and mercy today. The calendars that you rip off the page every day are the best. But that's the one that are, those are the ones that are the top of the charts. If you ask the International Presbyterian Calendar Popularity Leadership Committee, Nominating Committee Committee, for 3 years running, they loved those in flip-off calendars with inspirational quotes. Those were at the top of the charts. And if you've heard me in the pulpit before, you may remember that I do love quotes, and the more inspirational and usually the odder, the better. Also, a fun fact about me, I totally cry during really inspirational parts of movies, those odd times at movies when the main character like finally gets it, finally understands, or the team finally starts working together and finally starts moving in the same directions. And I cry sometimes even at these inspirational quotes that I read, and I just it just impacts me and hits me so hard and so palpable sometimes. An old friend who I haven't spoken to in years, recently gave me a flip calendar on inspirational quotes, totally out of the blue. It was on friendship and enemies. And I was like, oh, nice. Sorry, I've never called you back before. You're such a thoughtful friend. I love inspirational quotes about friendship and enemies. You probably weren't trying to tell me anything, were you? He was. But I saved some of them. And then I typed them in my phone so I wouldn't remember them, and so that Google and Alexa and Siri will be able to remind me of them when I need them. Here are a few of my favorites. J.K. Rowling wrote this in one of her Harry Potter books. It takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to your enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends. Kurt Cobain, singer of Nirvana, friends are nothing but a known enemy. Martin Luther King, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Aristotle once wrote, the antidote for 50 enemies is one friend. Stephen King wrote, I'm getting nervous to share this right now, because as soon as I said Stephen King wrote, you all went, what's he going to say? Stephen King wrote, only enemies speak the truth. Friends and lovers lie endlessly caught in their web of duty to you. Abraham Lincoln said, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? And my favorite on the list is another one by Martin Luther King Jr. It says, love is the only force capable, of transforming an enemy to a friend. Words like this are powerful, and they can shape who you are and who I am and how we feel and view the world around us, the power to not only change you, but also to change the people and the powers in your life. Some of those powers that feel like they're sometimes always against you, always your enemy at every turn. And I'm not kidding. I actually know a quote that has the power to thwart all of your enemies. We've been in this sermon series, double-clicking and zooming in on a few areas of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus continues his teaching in Matthew 5, verse 38, and he says this, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But where would these people have heard it from, you might ask? It's this law in the Old Testament called the law of retaliation. And you can find examples of it in Exodus 21 and Leviticus 24 and in Pastor Brian's favorite book of the Bible, Deuteronomy. Right, Brian? You love it. Chapter 19. You see, the way it worked in most of the world was that official punishment or jail time, even taxes, fees, etc., were kind of unregulated. So if someone did something wrong, depending on how wealthy they were or how well-connected their family was, their punishment may be drastically over-harsh or incredibly weak. So God commanded his people to do things a little bit differently. The law of retaliation means that the punishment cannot be harsher than the crime. When we hear an eye for an eye with our kind of modern ears through our own filters, it can sound a little harsh, like a mean and vengeful God, like God's up there, well, I'll teach you to poke someone's eyes out. We're going to let him poke your eye out. We'll see how many eyes you poke out before you stop, right? It's not this mean, vengeful God trying to teach us how pain is, but in the first century, it was this law to protect those that cannot protect themselves, whether they are innocent or guilty of a crime. It's a little Old Testament law that we can actually learn a lot from today. It gave hope to those without hope, those who have squandered hope away, who took advantage, who large and small, use someone else to get ahead, putting that person a little farther behind than them. Something we've all done in life and will continue, unfortunately, to do. It's a law that says no matter who you have wronged or how you have been wronged, you will never face more punishment than what you have caused. It's God bringing justice to the poor, to the oppressed, to the downtrodden, and to the hopeless. And God's justice will reign like his love. It cannot be stopped. And the law of retaliation also says that equal in God's justice is God's grace. Like the prophet Jeremiah in Lamentations, we find hope in these ashes of destruction. Even hope for the lawbreaker, for the criminal, for the outcast, the unwanted, the undesired, and the vengeful. It means that no matter what, you will be judged fairly, that you have worth and value. Similar to how it was said by the great Dr. Martin Luther King, again, that men are to be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of one's character. There's hope in knowing that no matter how unfair life can seem sometimes, no matter how life has been unfair to you or to other people, you will always have dignity and respect in the eyes of the Lord because you are a son or a daughter of the King and made in the very image of God. In God's kingdom, there is equal justice. No matter what party, no matter family or finances that we claim. And Jesus goes on then in verse 39. He says this, "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them and slap the other cheek also." If you got the study guide for this morning, there's one part in it that I totally stole from Curtis. It was from an old study guide that he did a long time ago, and I ripped this part off. It's that stand in front of someone, and if your right cheek, is slapped, it means they're either using their left hand or the back of their right hand, right? So both of those scenarios are actually bad news for the person getting slapped. Not only are they getting slapped, but because in the first century, you used your hand, your left hand, to do things you didn't want your right hand to do because you wanted your right hand to stay clean to like eat with. And your left hand, you did other things with. I'll let you look that up on Google if you don't know what it is. Either way, it's Gorosaurus rex, okay? And to strike someone, though, with the back of your right hand was considered, meant that you considered your opponent or the person that you were slapping to be beneath you and too weak to withstand a slap from your full palm. Either way, it's bad news for the person getting slapped, and we're all going to get slapped in life. Jesus is reminding us that if you are all in with him, I mean all in, then people are gonna slap us and slap you. People will take advantage of you and even try maybe to destroy you simply because they can, or they believe their life has more value than yours. But Jesus is saying, you have worth, you have dignity, you have hope, you are a child of the King and made in the image of God. So when you get slapped on the right cheek, stand up. Give them your other cheek. Don't let them demean you. If you're getting slapped, get slapped as an equal and take it. I don't know if Jesus would say take it on the chin, but in my mind, you know, it's like take it on the chin, but, you know, it's not quite exactly the same as that. But if you're going to get slapped, turn the other cheek and stand there and take it as an equal. Make them insult you as an equal. Verse 40, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. This one's kind of neat because we're a little bit more familiar with it. If you say someone would give you the shirt on their own back, you're either saying that they're very comfortable with their own skin or so selfless that they would give you something that they need, even if it's at significant cost to them, something that you need that they also need, even if it's at significant cost to them. We generally approach this from kind of a standpoint of excess and of wealth. Like, it's like, please, oh, no, take my shirt. Honestly, though, I've got like 20 more of these. I got them at Costco, you know? We also, for some reason, kind of under-exaggerate the sacrifice with this in order to prove the point. I mean, it's just a shirt, right? I've got so many more in my drawers, but to those who were listening to these words, and when Jesus was speaking to those who were tired, who were hungry, who might have been cold and didn't have enough to get them warm, those that had been taken advantage of at every turn by life, knowing that their life and their work was only this endless perpetuating cycle, which even their children's children would never be able to escape, knowing that the well-being of their family, their entire people group, and potentially their entire history are in constant threat of destruction by powers beyond their control. They heard that. Those were the people that Jesus was talking to. And they knew what Jesus was talking about. They had been the ones that had owed someone else that shirt in court. They knew the man in Jesus' story. They knew that he might have even done something wrong. At minimum, he owed the plaintiff a sum of money that he could not afford to pay. But they also knew that he was really an honest man, just trying to get work for the rest of his family. They knew because Jesus was talking to them about them. This man on trial may have made a bad deal, a bad investment. He may have broke the law, and he must pay for his crime. After all, we are a nation of laws, but maybe some of them thought, to be honest, though, he can't even prove that he was born here, so do the same rules still apply in the kingdom of God? Side note, if you are hearing political undertones, they're not 100% intentional, but rather an unfortunate byproduct, I believe, of our current kind of geopolitical environment that we're in, and that God's scriptures really does speak to the everyday of our lives. The point is that Jesus is saying that life isn't fair. You will be taken advantage of. You will be treated unequally. But the difference between you and them is vast. They will begrudgingly pay their dues out of their excess, using money and power like a lifeboat available only on their deck on the sinking ship of the Titanic. But you, Jesus says, you are different. You stand in the face of injustice. And like Jesus, who gave all of his life for you, Jesus is saying that you, that God's kids are different because you're willing to give it all too. To give everything to Jesus. Even if that means losing it all for doing the right thing. And when you do, it changes everything. It changes you. It changes the world around you. Even and especially changing those systems and those people that seem like they're your enemy, or that feel like they're your enemy, constantly and always against what you are for. Those who heard Jesus talking that morning understood what it meant to fail and to succeed, to flourish and to be trampled on. In verse 41 and 42, Jesus goes on, "If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give them one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." See, there was this rule for a Roman soldier. He could commandeer any Jew to carry their bags for free up to 1 Roman mile. It's totally messed up, right? Again, when life is unfair, when you have to do something you shouldn't have to do, Jesus is saying sometimes the best way to make a change in the world around you is to go the extra mile. And that's not just from AMPM's slogan. It's what it means to be part of God's kingdom. To go the extra mile, not for someone that you like, not for someone that you want to help, maybe even not for someone that needs your help, but even for the one that you are required or forced to help, even if it's someone that holds power over you. I think most of us are all starting to get the point. Some of you are like, "Josh, do you have a point?" And I do, so stick with me. But Jesus is reminding his followers that the powers and the principalities of this world cannot stop the love that Jeremiah wrote in Lamentations. This love of God that is new every morning, his mercy and grace cannot be stopped. That you are never in the losing hand in being part of making God's kingdom come. In verse 43, you have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And here we go. This is it. The quote with the power to change everything. Love your neighbor, love your enemy. Again, where they heard this before, the first part, love your neighbor, is from the book of Leviticus, chapters 19 and 8, verse 18. The second, hate your enemy, is not in Leviticus or in the Old Testament. It's actually most likely a rabbinical teaching about this chapter in Leviticus, or perhaps a populist idea that advantaged those in power. And then it became the operating norm. They had heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy, but Jesus has something else to say about it, something that will change the world. Verse 44, he says, I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And to that, Jesus, I say, what? I'm all about doing the right thing, Jesus. Taking the high road, unless I'm in an argument with my wife, and the only way to win is to fight dirty. But other than that, I'm all in, Jesus. The high road and doing it right, maybe all up until this point that you said, love your enemies and to pray for those who persecute me. See, in Greek, this account in Matthew uses the word agape for love. Matthew could have used eros or romantic love, and it would have been like Jesus said, and like smooth jazz music played in the background, love your enemies, yeah, right? So like my enemies are trying to fight me, and I'm like, oh, but Jesus said love your enemies, and I'm like, let's hug it in, buddy, right? Love your enemies. I don't know how effective that may be. That works with Benjamin, but I don't know if that works with everyone. He didn't use the word eros for love. He could have used the word philia. It's like a kinship, a camaraderie, a friendship, unbreakable bonds, like pinky swears are philia. Your old Sunday school teacher. Don't forget, kids, Jesus said to pinky swear your enemies. But Paul didn't use philia for love either. He used agape. Agape is more than just about one person. It's about everyone. It's these actions that spur life to flourish. Agape love is love that gives in the full knowledge that it will never be given back. Agape love is selfless and them more. Agape love is sacrificial love. So Jesus, agape love for my enemies? Honestly, Jesus, agape love is sometimes difficult with my own family. And I love them with all that I have. For my enemies, that's going to be hard. And if I'm really honest about my enemies, I actually don't know any of my enemies personally. I mean, there's Curtis, but he's the boss, so he has to be the enemy. And Brian and Janae are way too nice to be anyone's enemies. Don't get me wrong, though. I'm not saying that everyone out there likes me, because I would be delusional if I thought that. There are more people than I would like to imagine that simply don't like me. Some because of the way I walk or dress, or maybe because I can be rough, abrasive, and off-putting. Maybe that's it. And there's going to be people that don't like you either, or people that you don't like. But there are some people who will just not like you. They'll dislike you for things that you cannot control, or maybe even things that you can. Maybe because the color of your skin is different. There are going to be some people in this world who dislike you, and people that you dislike because of their political affiliation, their political ideology, or even their lack thereof. People will disagree all the time. I'm not talking about disagreeing, but who are our enemies? What are our enemies? I can tell you who it is for me, and it's going to sound trite. But honestly, for me, it's a real issue. My enemies are other people that are driving at the same time that I am driving on the road. I'm not kidding. I get angry. And suddenly, it's like my right and my civic duty to inform them that I dislike how they are driving. Maybe it's an easier way to think of it. Maybe it's, who do I hate? Now, you don't need to say the name of the person out loud. If you already have and they're in the room, just move on. Honestly, though, the person doesn't even need to have a name that you hate. They might have another skin color, or religion, or political affiliation. Who are the people that hate the things that you want to stand for? Maybe it's those people. You know what? It's got to be them. It's got to be them. And Jesus says for us, though, to love them. Not only that, to agape them, to want the best for them, to go out of our way for them, for those enemies. Because do you know what will happen if we don't, as followers of Jesus? Nothing. Nothing will happen. And that cycle of continual hate and evil will continue. And until we stand up and love our enemies, it will continue. But when you do, start to love, to want the best for your enemies, to love the one that you hate, what happens is you feed that spark of hope that Jeremiah saw in the ashes and the destruction of God's city. And when you do love, I mean really start to love those you hate, it changes you and it changes them. And an old day gets ripped off of that calendar. And a new day for you and a new day for them begins with God's love and with God's mercy. Will you pray with me?